What is your suggestion to directors or beginning directors or people who are trying to, I guess, help character or help actors define their characters to an extent to get that overlap? If you know, because this is you described this as something that you find that that important. What is a way to get there?
Yeah.
I guess is sort of the. I mean, that's different with everyone.
You know, part of it is casting, but you know, beyond that, it really is up to the actor to find some, because I don't know each of these actors well enough to be able to dig deep into their past and know where they can find that, you know, that truth that they need in every scene. And all I could do is help guide them there. So, you know, in that scene, you know, where Aubrey needed to be is, you know, she'd just seen this guy do this crazy thing and take a gun into a laser facility and rob it. And now he's, you know, telling her this story that may or may not be true, but is really heartfelt, and she wants to feel sympathy for him. So all I could say to her, and what I did say, is, you know, have you ever been in love with someone who you know is a little crazy and a little damaged? And have you ever tried to talk them down from their neuroses and their psychosis and get them to that place, you know, where you guys can have a regular conversation? And I don't know what her answer was to that, but she found it, and she had one. It was in there. And, you know, you actually see it. The best example of her finding that, I think, in the movie is she gives this amazing look towards the end when the two of them are, she's confronting him in his room, and he's going off with, you know, it's a complicated science, and he's going off on his thing, and she stops him. He's like, hey, and like really tries to pull him in and almost give him like this hug with her eyes, and you can tell that comes from somewhere. Just, hey, like, just talk to me right now. Put the crazy aside for a second.
Right. Now, the story itself, I understand that there actually was, and the backstory, I guess, for folks who aren't familiar with the story already, it's the centers around a want ad. Mm. And the want ad says, you know, looking for partner in time travel, right. Bring your own firearms, must be willing, must be willing to travel or whatever, you'll be paid on return, safety not guaranteed. Serious inquiries only.
Right.
That's the general gist of it, from what I remember. There was an actual want ad, was there not, or something along those lines?
It was published in Backwoods Home magazine in 1997, and since then, I came, you know, turned into this internet meme where they added on this guy with a sort of flat top mullet and a song called "Push It to the Limit," which, you know, we unfortunately couldn't get the rights to Push to the Limit, but we try to at least tip our hat to the mullet. With he has, you know, Mark has a sort of Huey Lewis 84 mullet going, and you know, it really just took on a life of its own, and it, you know, those, it's six sentences, and we optioned those. We really bought the rights to those sentences like it was a novel or anything else. It might be the shortest literary option in history, but you know, I felt that in them, even though there's not necessarily a story and it doesn't suggest, you know, the story that we tell, I see so many of the aspects of that character, the bring your own weapons, the sort of longing to he's going back in time for a reason, clearly. He's got a mission, and it's probably like anyone's mission would be. It's going to be emotional and personal. He's not going back to kill Hitler. He's going back because, like, something went wrong in his life, and he wants to fix it, and he wants to find the bend, like, find that place where everything went wrong so he can change that trajectory and have things go right. And that's what pulled me into it, and I think that's what made Derek feel like there was not only a story but potentially a love story and a way for, you know, two people who both had, you know, a regret to want that and need a time machine.
The film overall has actually, let me take it in kind of a different direction. I was thinking for a second. The thing that strikes me particularly interesting about the film is you've got this feel to it and this look to it, and then when we actually get to the end, and I don't want to reveal what happens,
right.
But you do. There is CG involved, and it looks great. It's fantastic. Yet, you know, you're working within your means. You're working within a budget here. Where does that? I guess the first question is, where does that come from? Was that done here in Seattle, or is that done, you know?
It was actually done in Philadelphia.
Okay.
A company called Dive, and they're a pro company. They do all of M. Night Shyamalan's movies.
Okay.
So they had just come off of the one with, you know, everyone throwing fire and water at each other.
Oh, yeah.
And, you know, regardless of the film, cool special effects.
Yeah, the Last Airbender.
Yeah, Last Airbender. Yeah. And, you know, and what that was, I mean, they gave us an incredible price, so it was possible within our means, but the only way it was possible is that I had six shots. I had to choose specifically six shots where there were special effects, and maybe I ended up getting eight, but two of them ended up just being lens flares, and like very, very specific choices. One of the big effect shots is when, you know, she walks into camera and you see this big, long, blue, like, Lomo anamorphic lens flare.
Mm-hmm.
You know, that's that we had to put that in there, and I think it's crucial. And, you know, I had to go through and really just be very careful and judicious, and this is how we're going to do this, and we're going to really base the effects on the practical as opposed to the other way around. So we had this thing that I had to sort of retroactively, like, reverse engineer. Okay, well, it looks like this would happen, and then this would happen. And
yeah.
And we also, you know, the thing that I really spent a lot of time with those guys working on is to give the effect sort of an emotion of its own, and there's a point right towards the very end of that effect where it kind of breathes in and out like this, and it makes you do that. You go when it happens, and that to me was an exciting way to make an effect, give someone an emotional response that they're so ready to have. And then in addition, we did the sound at Skywalker.
Okay.
For that sequence, we did much of the sound. We did a first pass up here at Clatter and Din, and they did a fantastic job. And then we were able to go down there, do another pass to really, you know, give it that sheen. And then they handled the time machine sequence. And there are, you know, you've got Titanic boat creaks and, you know, all kinds of stuff in there. And I also was able to go through and, you know, the birds in the forest are like Endor birds.
Oh, okay.
You know, so there's a lot of buried stuff for Star Wars fans in there.
Wow. Okay, I'd be curious to know more about that. That's been one of the things I work on the side as well, is do, you know, a lot of post audio sort of stuff.
Yeah.
Now, in this film in general, generally, I guess all films, you could say this too, there's this thing of what's known as killing your baby,
mm-hmm.
which is the one scene that you absolutely love, but for time reasons or for budgetary reasons or whatever it has to be, an editor or a director has to cut it from the film. Now, you've said that the film was tightly scripted, and for a reason you had to stay, you know, within these means. Did you in fact have to kill a baby in this film?
I did.
As well?
I did, and it was actually at the very end, and it's what happened after the way the film ends now.
And that actually is a big question mark.
Yeah.
So,
and I, you know, I don't want to go too deep into what it was, but there was just a really nice scene that no one's ever going to see. We don't want to show our cards on that one.
Right.
Like, we really, and yet there was a really nice scene that was a piece of acting from Jake Johnson and Aubrey Plaza. It was just the two of them talking, but it really wrapped up, you know, what Jake's arc was in the film, and he's actually a really, you see that he's actually a really good guy, and he gives her a wonderful piece of advice, which is, you know, what he's learned, you know, essentially to do whatever you got to do in life before you need a time machine to fix it.
Right.
And it was a nice sentiment, you know,
right.
and yet we had to make a choice to do what we did, and after we do that, there's no conversation
right.
between those two characters, and so, you know, we had to lose it, I guess it was a bummer to lose it for the story, but it was also a bummer because you really have the culmination of a great piece of acting from Jake Johnson, and you really see what he did and the scope of what he did.
Right. Now, in the case of Jake, we get to follow his story a little bit as well. You've got kind of several things going on here all at once.
Yeah.
When writing screenplays, seems like a much more common theme that we're seeing nowadays are these multiple storylines all running together.
Mm-hmm.
Whereas, say, even 20 years ago, we didn't have half as much of that going on.
Yeah.
What is your take on kind of this? Does this make... I mean, obviously, this is the way it's put together. This film's put together that way.
Yeah.
Why do you think that is, I guess?
Well, why it is, I don't know if there's a... theory as to why. I feel like this particular film, the idea was to have a literal time travel story and a sort of metaphorical thematic time travel story as your A and your B story. And the way it ended up, you know, especially in the second half of the film, they really do run concurrently, and neither one has more screen time than the other. And I, you know, the thing that I think this movie breaks certain screenwriting rules. I think this movie, it breaks those rules in that, you know, we sort of put the brakes on the plot for like 15 minutes, like two-thirds into this movie.
Yeah.
And we know we do that. You know, we're very conscious of it. And we just take that time to, we just let all the ingredients just simmer for a while before like really, you know, hitting the gas in the last, you know, act of the movie. And we also do other weird things. You know, we end the arc of Jake and Karin's story at the end of the second act of the movie. You know, there's really nothing with them.
Right,
you know,
right.
They're in it, but it's all about the time machine. And we didn't know if that was necessarily going to work and if it was going to be engaging at all. And yet, you know, a lot of it is, you know, it's instinctive. It's also knowing what the rules are and knowing you're breaking them. Mm-hmm. And hopefully having, you know, there weren't, hopefully at least being adept enough that you can move the pieces around if necessary. But, you know, I think also what having two storylines does do, especially, you know, as long as they are variations on a theme, mm-hmm. is you're able to look at your theme from two different angles, two different perspectives, or more than two perspectives. And I think especially in this movie, it's very helpful. You know, Jake Johnson's character sees the world in a completely different way than right. Aubrey does, and so you get to look at, you know, what time travel is to him. Mm-hmm. And I think and in the end, it might make it more appealing to more people, because a lot of people are going to walk out of this movie feeling like Jake Johnson's story was the story they connected to in the mm-hmm. film, and other people connected the love story. And you know, of the criticisms I've heard of the film, people who don't connect to Jake's story, they don't understand why it's in the movie, and they feel the movie just completely spins its wheels and devolves because of that.
Interesting.
So, you know, that can happen. If something isn't grabbing you, if you don't know why you're there, and I could, you know, we spent a lot of time with him.
Right.
You know?
Right. Yeah, and you do. So, interesting. Okay. So, what's next for you at this point? I mean, the film is starting to roll out. You're going to see a number of cities initially here, mm-hmm. Seattle, New York, L.A., and then kind of breed on, but... next projects for you? I mean, getting this out is a big
Getting one. This out is big. Yeah, I have a personal project in that I'm going to go have another baby. So my wife and I are going to be in France in the summer doing that because she's from there, and we try and surround ourselves with family. And I have some new projects that I'll be writing. I mean, they are directing projects that are larger in scope and budget, but luckily, and some of them are studio projects, but. What has attracted those studios, or this studio, to Derek and I is the things, you know, it's the things we like about this movie. It is the warmth and, you know, the emotionality of a sci-fi film, and they're looking to bring that into a larger kind of a film. And I think that what I would love to offer, you know, if any new filmmaker has their little thing that they contribute to, you know, this vast quilt of film, is, you know, trying to take a little bit more of a step forward in having bigger, you know, films that are cinematic and all the things that we love about big Hollywood summer movies that have a naturalism and a really human emotional element to them that takes it even a step further than what even the Avengers is doing now. And you know, and that's why, you know, the blending of kind of the mumblecore vibe and right. you know, where I live, you know, that Spielberg Donner 80s Zemeckis vibe, I think those two things, you know, they make nice harmony in this movie, and I don't think that it should be limited to tiny, small budget movies.
Right. Well, cool.
All right, man.
Very good. Thank you much for your time, man.